We are leaving the Garden of Gethsemane in Mark chapter 14, verse 52. We just got through the two verses or so where it seems that Mark has written himself into the story. At least that was my assertion, which you're allowed to disagree with. Where a young man wearing nothing but a fine linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. Verse 53. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, and teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they couldn't find any. If I'm going to be playing off of Drew's prayer right off the bat, it'd just be this simple devotional thought. May that be the same, may that truth about Jesus be the same thing that's true about you. I mean, you'll have people that they just want to undercut you. A lot of times it's because of your message. A lot of times it's because you don't agree with their message. Or a lot of time it's because what you're fighting for will cut into other people's agendas and you don't even realize how it is. Matter of fact, you'll even find that somewhat in academia as you keep going. Man, you'll be somebody that'll just be critiquing you like crazy. And you're going, I don't even know why they're critiquing me. And then all of a sudden you read one of their books and you realize, if what they say, if what I say is right, then it destroys their whole agenda. And sometimes you'll have that in the church where, man, you have no idea why this becomes, there are things called sacred cows in the church where you don't even realize it, but they are sacred. You don't touch them. You don't mess with them. And if you do, somebody will have a cow. I mean, it just be, they go crazy. Sacred cows, don't mess with them. Sometimes what's weird is you walk in and within the first year you're like, oh yeah, I know what the sacred cows are, and you'll list them out. And then 18 months later, your job's being threatened by a sacred cow you didn't even know existed. And it was all because you decided to put this wreath up in this place, you know, and it just freaked people out. A lot of times people's agendas, you don't even see where they're coming from. When their agendas come to light and they're looking for accusations against you, you make sure that they can't find any. You just make sure you're so stinking integrity driven that they just literally they have no chance of even accusing you. And I am very Ken Idleman-ish, Mark Scottish. Wait a minute, I don't know if I can do Scottish. I don't know, maybe I can. Man, I do protect my integrity even to the point where sometimes I can be miscommunicated. Sometimes I can be misconstrued as being, what's the word? Not accessible, especially for the opposite sex. I just guard that like the pearl of great price. Your integrity, literally, it's one of those things where, like, if a girl accuses me of making an advance at her in my office, the possibility of that is so minimal because my door is always open if there's somebody of the opposite sex. I'm always making sure other people are in the building. And usually I'll limit my conversations with someone of the opposite sex to a smaller duration of time. And it's not because I'm not accessible. I just trust the Holy Spirit that there are other women in the church that can take care of the needs of those girls. Your integrity is worth a lot to the point where when you go on trial, I hope the people have a hard time finding out things to accuse you of. But one of the things is, a lot of times we use some of these accusations as badges of honor in our day and age to the point where literally people just don't have understanding of boundaries. If you've never thought about what are the boundaries I should have in my life or what boundaries should I be paying attention to to protect my other brothers and sisters in Christ, if you never thought through those issues, that's a problem. You need to think through those. Maybe a lot of times one of the problems that we have with people, especially freshmen coming in, they don't even understand the concept of boundaries. It's not high school anymore. It's the real world. Your best friend, if they're not your spouse, can't be the opposite sex anymore. You're moving into that phase where that's just not very much commonplace anymore. Is that making sense? It's not because, you know, we're anti-community. That, if you know me, that you know that's the exact opposite of my heart. But I believe in the full body of Christ. And I believe that where I can't fill a void for someone of the opposite sex, that the Holy Spirit has someone to fill that. That's why a lot of times if girls come in and they're asking me about, you know, stuff that's like going to take more than one session or whatever, I say, hey, you know what? Maybe you can get coffee with my wife. She's great. And she really is, and she really can help you out. Anyway, I just hope that devotionally speaking, if you go on trial, the same thing can be said about you. They looked to find evidence to accuse him, and they just couldn't find any. Kind of sounds Davidic a little bit. The chief priests were in the whole of Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they couldn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements didn't agree. They even started Trump. Hey, you know what? What is Trump up stuff? The problem is they start contradicting themselves. Like, well, that's not going to help. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple and in 3 days will build another, not made by man. Now here's my question. Did Jesus say that? What? I hear rumblings, but I'm not sure I can get a yes or a no on that. Did Jesus say that? What? Yes. Help me. Yes. Where? Or what? What did he say? Like what?
Like he meant obviously his body, but he was telling them that he could tear down, or that he's going to tear down the temple in 3 days, and in 3 days it'll be rebuilt again.
Mm-hmm.
And so like he alluded to that.
Mm-hmm. Here's the interesting thing. Does he say that in Mark? No. He says it in John chapter 2 at the first cleansing of the temple. But he doesn't say it in Mark's gospel. He says half of it in Mark's gospel, doesn't he? What half does he say in Mark's gospel? This temple is going down. Matter of fact, that's what the whole last three chapters were about, was it not? From chapter 11, the cursing of the fig tree, to the cleansing of the temple, to the cursing of the fig tree, to the say to the mountain, go into the water, into the sea, and it will be thrown in there. All the way to chapter 13 with him and his disciples for 31 verses or so. He's talking about the destruction. He says half of it. But he does not say the full phrasing. That comes in John chapter 2. Nevertheless, even when they were saying this, you look at verse 59, here's the problem with what they're saying. Yet even then, their testimony didn't agree. Yeah, he said he was going to tear it down and build up in 3 days. Well, I heard him say he was going to tear it down, but I didn't hear him say he was going to build up in 3 days. Well, I heard he said he was going to... He didn't say he was going to tear it down, but God was going to... Their testimonies can't agree. They want to find a way to accuse Jesus. Why? What is their goal? It's already been stated in the text, but what is their goal? Kill him. Because their kingdom advances through violence. That's the only way they know how to react to a situation. How can we kill him? We will throw out the entire rule book, whether it is lying, cheating, deceiving, whatever we need to do in order to accomplish our goal. Period. Then some stood up and, oh, wait a minute. Verse 59. Yet then, even then, their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? They're given accusation after accusation, and what does Jesus do? He just stands there, or sits there. Probably wouldn't let him sit. Just stands there. I don't need to give an accusation. I don't need to give a response. Why? Why wouldn't Jesus need to give a response? Yeah, maybe it's because the more they talk, the more they're shooting themselves in the foot. Sometimes that's the best defense whenever somebody's coming after you is just not talking. Seriously. Especially whenever their emotions are off the charts, one of the best things you can do is just shut up and just smile. And then finally they say, aren't you going to say anything? Do I really need to? You're trying to prove in this moment that I'm erratic and we're going to take your word for it? Sometimes the best thing you do is just shut up and let them shoot themselves in the foot. Why else would Jesus not need to be speaking here? Yeah?
Because of his sanity and him continuing to follow the cross.
Say that again. Explain it to me more.
Because, I feel like actually shame them like he's done before. But since he's not, he's just continuing to let them go on with their trial.
Yeah, you said a word that I like that I think really does come to play here, the word shame. There is an honor-shame situation that's happening here. Remember, we've talked about this before. In an honor-shame situation, no response is a response. It is a response. And the crowd has to decide whether or not the response of no response is legitimate. In other words, sometimes you don't respond because you don't have a defense. Sometimes that's why you don't respond. But that hasn't been typically the way in which Jesus has responded to these accusations, now has it? Sometimes you don't respond because the people that are questioning you or that are challenging you are not worthy on an honor level of you even responding. And it's possible that the high priest, notice the one that throws this question at Jesus, gets a little upset because he knows Jesus has an answer for these accusations, but he's refusing to talk. He's saying, are you suggesting that your honor is so elevated above ours that we don't even merit a response? You're just going to sit there and just let us keep going? Jesus says, what do you want me to say? It's possible that we have an honor play here. Matter of fact, it's going to be the same thing in just several verses that's going to surprise and even amaze Pontius Pilate. Jesus refuses to talk. Why? Because I think there's an honor-shame tug-of-war going on here. What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. No answer is always an answer. No answer is always an answer. It's kind of one of the things where sometimes you'll even see this in the public. We still have this on some level in our public, media, even to this day. You know, somebody will like a big political tycoon, will get asked a question, hey, this guy said this about you, how would you respond? And sometimes they'll say, I'm not going to even respond to that. And the fact that they're not giving a response, the rejection of a response is rejecting not just the question, but the person. Because they're saying, they're not worthy for me to stoop down and even listen to their question, more or less answer it. It's possible that that's what Jesus is communicating here. And it's true. But the irony of this is that it's the high priest that is asking these questions. That Jesus says, why should I even answer? Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ? Ah, now we're getting to the heart of the issue. Because really all the other stuff has been just superfluous. Jesus knows that what they're doing is they're going around the things of the peripheral. But the real issue is his identity. It always has been. They're saying, are you going to destroy the temple? He's like, why do we even need to be talking about this? Well, you know, we're trying to find some accusation. Are you going to be, you know, raining down fire and trying to build a temple yourself? I'm not going to answer this. Are you the Christ? Ah, now we're getting somewhere. It's always been about my identity. Are you the King? The Son of the Blessed One? Are you the Christ, the Son of God? How did Mark's Gospel begin? What is it? The beginning of the Gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, the Son of God. See what's happening? Mark's saying, don't forget everything so far. You knew this political explosion was coming just by my very first verse. You knew it was coming. High priest looks at him and says, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, the Son of God? Jesus says, ego me. You hear that? He doesn't just say, yeah, that's about right. He says, ego me. Which in John chapter 8, verse 58, when Jesus says, before Abraham was born, ego me, verse 59, they pick up stones to stone him. Why? Because at about this time, it is thought that the phrase ego me in the Greek was a reference to the name of God uttered in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Whenever Moses says, who will I tell them has sent me? And God says, you tell them I am has sent you. Ego me. And Jesus in John 8:58 says, before Abraham was born, ego me. And now his response here is more emphatic than just saying, yeah, you know, I am the Christ and the Son of God. He said, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego me. Oh, now we're getting somewhere. Those are called blasphemy charges, friends, and that's what comes up just in a minute. Although Jesus elaborates on this a bit. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One. Where does that come from? Say it again. Close. It's actually a hybrid combination quote. The sitting at the right hand of God, of the Mighty One, comes from where? Hopefully, Drew, that you can throw this one out here for me. There we go. Psalm 110. The reason why I said that is because I just read his paper the other day. And he was writing on this very issue. Psalm 110, which is pretty intriguing, and I actually agree with what Drew was talking about in his paper on this point. He doesn't just go straight to Psalm 110 for no reason. Who is asking him the questions here? Huh? High priest. What is Psalm 110 focusing on? The Messiah is in the order of what? Melchizedek. It's possible that Jesus is saying, oh, I'm not just the Christ. I don't just hold the king position. I also hold yours. Because you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. I think that that hybrid is Jesus bringing king and priest together. Absolutely. Psalm chapter 110 and Daniel 7, you can't get more explosive than those two texts. You just can't. The Son of Man coming on the clouds. Here's the question, though. Is that second coming language or first? That is not a rhetorical question, and I'm hoping I get the answer I'm looking for. Is that second coming language or first coming language? First coming language. Why? Because of Daniel 7. For the Son of Man will enter the Ancient of Days, coming on the clouds, and he will receive the kingdom that will reign forever. And Jesus says, oh yeah, are you the Christ? Go at me. I'm actually the high priest and the king, and you're going to see it all get established real soon. Oh, that's beautiful, friends. That kind of language, though, will get you killed, and that's why the very next phrase happens. High priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses, he asked. What's Jesus just been convicted of? Blasphemy. And it's tantamount to death. That is treason. You can get killed for that. You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. Their kingdom is still advancing in the exact same way it always has. Through violence. That's just what they know. It's just what they do. They respond, they get an accusation, and they can't even help themselves. Even though he's convicted, and they know that this can, and by their law, they can lead him to death. Although by the Roman law, that's a little bit different. We'll get to that in a minute. By their law, blasphemy is punishable by death. And even though that's where his fate lies, they can't help it. We're not going to hold him that. We just got to start beating him now and having some fun. Kind of like, little kids torturing an animal that they know they're going to kill. There's something sadistic about that's deeply disturbing on more levels than one. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. Exactly where he is, we don't really know. We just know he's nearby Jesus' court or trial. The exact location, it's really hard to determine. That's really not the point here. The point here is what's emphasized in the text. It is the person that's about to accuse Peter is emphasized in three different ways that presents this narrative in a very keen manner. Number one, the accuser is presented as a she. As a she. What's the problem with that? What's the oddity of that? Maybe I should rephrase that. She is addressing him, but she's a she. What's he afraid of? And their society, the she, unfortunately, was a parasite of society. They weren't worth anything. The accuser, number one, is a she. Number two, it's a little girl. It's a child. A female child. It's not just like this is just any random child. Even though little children are parasites of society as well. But this is the lowest category of child. A female child. And it gets even better because here's number three. She's a slave. So number one, she's a she. Number two, she's a little girl. And number three, she's someone else's property. And that's the accuser against Peter. Big, burly Peter. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. Now, what's significant about her accusation? Well, let me ask you this. What is significant about her accusation? What is significant about that? Say it again. Definitely, that's what the implications are, that it's guilt by association. But what else is significant about her accusation? That is where she is getting at. But what would make Peter panic? It is true. Yeah, that's one of the problems. Peter's like, you're dead on. What else, though? What about what she says? Knows what? That Jesus what? She knows that Jesus, she knows who the key figure is, but there's another little detail she throws in. Also Nazarene. Nazarene. Why is that significant? What? Galilee, the region, she will eventually be able to say, well, in Matthew's gospel, she doesn't say it here, but in Matthew's gospel, she says, "I can tell you're a Galilean by your accent." But that's the region. What was their base of operations as a ministry? What was the city that Jesus and his disciples? Where? Capernaum. She doesn't even mention Capernaum. What does she mention? Jesus' ethnicity. Where he's from. This is different than just saying, "Hey, I know you're from the general region." It's even different from saying, "Hey, aren't you from Capernaum?" It's saying, actually, I'm going to go one step further. I know that you're the one that follows the Nazarene, the ethnicity. It's hitting a little too close to home for Peter. Because her intimate knowledge of the movement is showing that she could implicate him very easily. So what does Peter do? Verse 68, he denied it. That's a real important word, the word deny here. The Greek word in this form only appears really two places. It'll be the same word, well, three places. It'll be the same word that's used again in 1470, that's being used here in 1468. But the only other time in this form that it is found in Matthew or Mark is in Matthew chapter 10, verse 33. "But whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father in heaven." The only other time that this word in this form is used by in Matthew or Mark is in Matthew chapter 10, verse 33, when Jesus says, "But whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father in heaven." And if you're hearing this narrative for the very first time, you may think that Jesus has just lost two disciples and not just one. Because Peter's word here is very strong. He denies him, and you're thinking, wait a minute, you can't. If you deny him before men or even a little slave girl, he says he'll deny you before your Father in heaven. This linguistic connection may put that verse in Matthew 10:33 in more of context, by the way. A matter of fact, at the persecution in the middle of the 3rd century, whenever some Christians, at the opportunity to die for Christ, they denied Christ. Whenever they tried to come back to the community, there was a major debate of whether or not the Christians should allow them to come back in because they denied Jesus. And I think this linguistic connection could have made that debate a little bit easier. And that is, Peter did deny Jesus just like they did. But Christ eventually let him back in. It's not an unforgivable sin, even though it's one that you don't want to commit. You following me? But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said. And he went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, it sounds like it's the same girl, just different location. I think that's what it is here. She said again to those standing by around, "This fellow is one of them." I mean, this guy is clearly one of them. And again, he denied it. Same word. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, "Surely you're one of them." I mean, you're a Galilean for crying out loud. How do they know he's a Galilean? Well, it's one of two options. It's definitely mentioned in Matthew chapter 26, verse 73 is the second option. The first option could also be their clothing, though. This is very easy to prove. All you got to do is go to the UK. We speak the same language with a little bit of a different accent. And even though the clothes are the same, there's something a little different about them. You can't even put your finger on it all the time. It's like I'll be seeing somebody walk and I'm just going, man, that shirt or those pants look like that they're from the UK. Why would I say that? I don't know. I just know they look a little different. I can't tell you why. It could be the clothing, because Galilean, being something more to the north, as opposed to where they are right now, there would be some clothing differences. There would not really be any skin color differences, though. It's possible there could be, but I doubt that that was something that was really, what's the word? Not influential, but something that was really determinative. But the accent, Matthew chapter 26:73, the accuser even says, surely you're one of them, for your accent gives you away. It'd be about as simple as us talking to somebody from the deep south and us being able to say, you're not from around here, are you? It's just, you're just able to catch it. Same way, it's pretty simple to see somebody from Britain over here or vice versa. So I remember the first time I realized that some people thought I had an accent. I don't know if you can remember that in your own life. Somebody's like, man, your accent's thick. I'm like, accent? I'm the base standard. Everything is odd from me on, is what I used to think. Now I realize that's not true. Have you ever heard somebody that's in, from the UK that speaks in an English accent, or I mean an American accent? It's actually pretty funny, because some of the words that they point out are like, they say that a lot, and I was like, huh, we do that. Anyway, okay, verse 71, he began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. As a matter of fact, whenever it says calling curses on himself, he swore to them. The word swore there is the word for oath. He takes an oath that he does not know this man. This word is only found in several key places in Mark and Matthew. Matthew chapter 5, verse 33, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, but I tell you, do not swear at all. Do not take an oath at all. Mark chapter 6, verse 23, we have Herod at the party being seduced by his daughter-in-law, stepdaughter, not in-law, but stepdaughter, takes an oath to give her whatever she wants. Same word. And now we have Peter that makes an oath, this time not even knowing Jesus, which leads me to this. Every time in Matthew and Mark that the word oath is used, it is always used in a negative way that compromises in allegiance to the kingdom that the person is supposed to be a part of. Every time. Every time. Chapter 14, verse 72. Immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. We're going to do one more mini word study to kind of get the impact of what's happening here. This word for disown in this form, which is closely related to the word deny, but it is different form. The word disown is the same word that we found in 14:30 when Jesus first said this phrase. Before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times. In addition, this is the same word that Peter uses in his vehement denial of this prediction in chapter 14, verse 31. When he says, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And the only other time that this word is used in Mark's gospel is in Mark chapter 8, verse 34, where Jesus says, if anyone will come after me, he must disown himself, deny himself, and take up his cross and follow me. So you have this interesting irony that's occurring right here. For in order to preserve his own life, Peter has to disown Jesus. And yet Jesus has already told him that if you disown, that the way in which you follow my kingdom is by disowning yourself, not by disowning me. And what you find is that Peter is still functioning off of a different political agenda. For whenever you're in a situation or in a kingdom which is fighting for violence, one of the things that you will do is preserve your own life at all costs. Even disowning that which is near and dear to you. It's survival of the fittest, and you got to do what you got to do. Peter breaks down and weeps because he knows that he has disowned the Lord instead of disowning himself. Chapter 15, verse 1. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. I'm sorry, I'm on a word study kick. But the word bound is very fascinating here. Because of the way in which the word bound functions throughout really the gospel narratives as a whole. Listen to this. Bound is used in Mark's gospel 6 times. Well, technically 8 times, but 6 times for personal beings. There are 2 times it's used for the donkey in chapter 11, but 6 times for personal beings. The first 2 times are in Mark chapter 5, verse 3 and verse 4. Who would that be in reference to? Chapter 5? The Gerasene demoniac. And it says that he could not be bound by chains. Why? Because he was bound in Satan's kingdom. See the irony? Jesus had to set him free, unbind him from Satan's kingdom, so that he then could once again be bound by chains. Oh, that's very odd, very strange. But the 2 times it's referenced to the Gerasene demoniac, it says he could not be bound by chains. The next, well, not the next time, but another time. I'm actually going to cluster these into different groups on reason, on purpose, even though chronologically throughout the gospel they're not in line. Okay? So the first 2 times that I'm referencing to is Mark chapter 5, verse 3 and Mark chapter 5, verse 4. The next time is Mark chapter 15, verse 7, where Barabbas is mentioned as being bound before he is set free by the people. But he is set free by Jesus' actions of taking his place on the cross, which we'll talk about that in just a minute. But what you have is the people that don't belong to Jesus' kingdom are unbound, are not able to be bound, or are released in some way, shape, or form from bondage by Jesus, or because of Jesus' ministry. But then you have Mark chapter 6, verse 17, where John the Baptist is described as being bound with chains. He belongs to the kingdom of God, and we see him physically in chains, and that those chains lead to his death. We then see Mark chapter 15, verse 1, which is where we're at right now, where Christ is bound in chains, and that will lead to his death. The only other time we see the word bound in Mark's gospel is in Mark chapter 3, verse 27, which some of you have referenced already. For Jesus, being accused, being empowered by Beelzebub, says the parable of the strong man. He says, in fact, no one can enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first binds the strong man. Then he can rob his house. So, all that word study to develop this irony. The irony of the word is this. All of the people that are dedicated to the kingdom of God, that is Jesus and John the Baptist, are bound in a situation that leads to their death. But everyone who is bound that belongs to the kingdom of Satan, the Gerasene demoniac or Barabbas, is set free by Jesus' ministry. It's a pretty powerful image. Where in essence, what it is saying is, our kingdom develops or it advances on the kingdom of Satan through us allowing ourselves to be bound to set others free. It's called cruciform ethics or cruciform living. We live in the shape of the cross. We allow ourselves to be bound physically because we know spiritually we are unbound, with the hope that those that are unbound physically can realize that they're in spiritual bondage and be set free. Simple word study, very powerful devotional impact. Now, why are they binding Jesus and leading him away and handing him over to Pilate, as verse 1 says? Because as much as the Jews wish they had power, they don't have all the power that they wish they had. The Romans do not allow their subjects of their empire to implement capital punishment. They're not allowed. Rome is the keepers of the peace. They are the keepers of the peace. They're the ones that give Pax Romana to the world, and they're the ones that keep it with the sword. And Rome says, as a result, you subjects are not the ones that are going to be able to implement any sort of your peacemaking, because that is our job. Therefore, if you have any problems that you want capital punishment for, you have to bring it to us. This is something the gods have given us, because we literally have the right to say if you live or if you die. We own you. As a matter of fact, listen to Nero, who is being quoted by Seneca here. He says this, Nero, which is the emperor right after or right around the time that this is being written, 68 is when Nero dies. Nero says, "Have I of all mortals found favor with heaven and been chosen to serve on earth as vicar of the gods? I am the arbiter of life and death for the nations. It rests in my power what each man's lot and state shall be. By my lips, fortune proclaims what gifts she would bestow on each human being. From my utterance, peoples and cities gather reasons for rejoicing. Without my favor and grace, no part of the world can prosper. All those many thousands of swords which my peace restrains will be drawn to my nod. What nation shall utterly be destroyed? Which banished? Which shall receive the gift of liberty? Which have it taken from them? What king shall become slave? And whose head shall be crowned with royal honor? What cities shall rise and which shall fall? This is mine to decree. Why do you have to go to Rome? It's not just that Rome's on an ego trip, it's that they claim to rule the world. And they are the arbiters of life. They say if you live or die. They say who gets crowned as king. They're the ones that own you. And the Jews understand that. And so they take Jesus to be handed over to Pilate. And Pilate asks this intriguing question right off the bat. Are you the king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. Now before we get to Jesus' answer, let's do a little bit about Pilate. Who is this Pilate figure? Pilate is the procurator of Judea, and he was appointed to that position in 26 to 36 by the emperor Tiberius. In 26, he gets the appointment, although because it was such a ridiculously tumultuous region, I'm not so sure if it was an appointment or a punishment. Nevertheless, Pilate takes the position as procurator of Judea, ruler of Judea in 26 through 36, which is only a couple years later. He's deposed after he tries to preserve his own political power through what he does to Jesus. This is an odd relationship, though, that's occurring between the Jews and Pilate at this moment. And we've already talked about that naturally the Jews had to because the Romans were the ones that were in charge. Nevertheless, Pilate and the Jews at this point have not had a good history. Josephus and Jewish Wars 2.9 through 2.4 describes a situation where just recently Pilate, at the cloak or through the cloak of night, brings into the city graven images of the emperor, into the city of Jerusalem, which would naturally make the Jews do what? What's that? Yeah, freak out. Why? Because it's graven images in the holy city of the emperor claiming to be the deity that only belongs to their God. So what happens is the Jews start going crazy. For 5 days, they're arguing with Pilate. Pilate finally tricks them by getting all the Jews in one location, and then all of a sudden, all the soldiers throw off their cloaks with their swords, and they're surrounding all the Jewish elite. And he says, either you say that it is okay not only for these images to be here, but to even be taken into your temple, or I'll kill all of you right now. All the Jewish elite. And incredibly, the Jewish elite look around, they all get on their knees and they stretch out their necks and they say, do what you must. And Pilate's sitting there going, oh, is this really a good idea for me to start off my ministry here in this region by killing all of the elite? So what happens? Pilate recants. He takes away all the images and they leave. An incredible moment where the Jewish kingdom decided to try to persist through nonviolence and got them somewhere. Pretty incredible moment. Nevertheless, what's odd is that Pilate and these groups are now teaming together for a common purpose, and that's to take care of the king of the Jews. I'll answer your question after class because I need to keep moving. I'm sorry. I only have 2 minutes. Are you the king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. Yes, it is as you say. You know, that is a little bit more emphatic in the English than it is in the Greek. Really, the Greek is emphasizing the word you. Technically, what the Greek says is you say. Which is can be more accurately translated, in my estimation, whatever you say. Or, if you say so. It's almost like this ambiguous question that is given to Jesus. Jesus offers an ambiguous answer. So, are you king of the Jews? Why is that significant question? Because this is not something, the Jews, what they convicted Jesus of the night before is not something that Rome would have killed Jesus for. Rome would not have said, oh, because you claim to be the Son of the Christ, because you claim to be the Anointed One, because you blasphemed, we're going to kill you. No, that's a religious dispute that they would look at the Jews and say, figure it out without violating the law. But whenever they say, oh, are you king of the Jews? You see, that is a position that Pontius Pilate was technically residing in because the Herod the Great's sons didn't earn the title after he died because of how evil they were. Herod the Great, who rules until about 4 AD or so, whenever he dies, although that's the death of Herod the Great's in major flux at this point. Or I said 4 AD, 4 BC. It's at major flux. It's possibly even a couple years after the time of Christ now. We can talk about that later. Nevertheless, whenever he died, his region was split up amongst his sons. Herod Archelaus would have been the one that was ruling over this region. He was so evil that at around 6, he was deposed by Rome, and Rome was ruling through procurators of this region ever since, and no one held the title of King of the Jews. After Pilate, it was awarded to Herod Agrippa and those that followed. But at this point, it was not awarded to anyone. And you couldn't claim it to yourself without claiming a position that only Rome could give you. Because in essence, what you are doing is bypassing the authority of Rome and taking a title that only belongs to them to give out. Hence Nero's quote, "To whom shall I crown kings of the regions? For all of this has been given by the gods for my decree." So when Herod asked Jesus the question, "Are you king of the Jews?" Notice the accusation by the Jews has shifted to put Jesus in a position where he could actually be accused of something deserving death by the Romans. And that's why the ambiguous question, which Jesus knows that's not what he was convicted of the night before, I think is given an answer by Jesus that's just as ambiguous. "It is as you say." Or really, no, that's a little bit more emphatic. "Whatever you say. If that's what you say I am, sure, let's go with that. But technically, I'm bigger than that." Because the night before, what he claimed to be is both king and priest. We'll stop there. If you have questions, by all means, come up and talk to me. Otherwise, I'll see you in the morning. Love you.